Thanks for listening in and joining us on the Australian Fitness Podcast. I'm your host, Russell Jarrett, physical performance coach, health club owner, fitness educator, and yes, all-round fitness geek. I'm the guy who probably trains on Christmas Day. I would rather lift a barbell than drink a beer, and I'm a student of all things training and physical improvement. So what are we all about here at the Australian Fitness Podcast? Let me set the scene for you. If you've dabbled in training, exercise, weight loss, muscle gain, getting stronger, getting leaner, running further, or have even the slightest interest in fitness and training, I think you'll get a lot out of this podcast. Australian Fitness Podcast, episode 39, Vicky Curiel, The Real Food Dietitian, part two. Vicky comes back on the show. Her previous episode was number 33, to discuss some basic questions and clear up some confusion around current nutrition trends and practices. What I like about Vicky is that, like me, she tries to strip things back to basics and explain them with a common sense approach, but supported by a healthy dose of science, data, and evidence over a long period of time of actually practicing her craft. So there's more valuable content in this episode. I hope you get something valuable from it. Vicky Curiel, The Real Food Dietitian. Australian Fitness Podcast, episode 39, and we have back on the show Vicky Curiel, who is a real food dietitian and a strength and conditioning coach. She has her own business. She trains lots of people and has done for many, many years, and she is very popular with listeners that are interested in health, fitness, dietetics, nutrition, optimal eating, optimal results. I mean, who isn't interested in that stuff? But we've got her back on the show because I did promise the listeners after our last episode, which was, for those listening, go back to episode 33 and you'll hear our first installment. We're up to episode 39. So we've had a few in between, but we did promise to get Vicky back, and she's here with us today. How are you, Vicky?
Oh, I'm really good. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent. Well. So we're going to go through, as I sort of spoke to you briefly before we went on air, we're going to go through a few basic questions that you and I get asked all the time, and these are questions that the, you know, Joe citizen out there is constantly asking questions along these lines, because they're the most commonplace and the ones that cause the most confusion. And as you and I spoke, you know, on episode 33, food is one of those topics that everyone at some point in time has feels confused about, or feels anxious about, or a little bit unsure. So let's try and answer some of those common questions today. What do you think about that?
That sounds great. Perfect.
All right, let's
Happy
do it.
To do that.
Let's do it. Okay, question number one. Are all carbs bad? Because you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, I'm cutting back on carbs, or I'm eliminating carbs. You know, how do you calm people's craziness and hysteria around carbohydrate intake? So talk to us about, along those general lines, are all carbs bad? How do you approach that?
Yeah, so a simple answer to that is no, not all carbs are bad. And I've become a real fan of this newish term which is nutrivores. You know, where people speak about us being omnivores or herbivores, you know, cows are herbivores and we are omnivores. We eat plant-based food plus animal food, and then you have your carnivores. But what I really liked was this term, which is nutrivores. And the reason why I like it is because what we should be looking at when we decide if we're going to eat a food or not is, what is the nutrient value of this food in relation to the calories in it? Or more specifically to your question, what is the nutrient value of this food? So what are the vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, all these other bits and pieces that I'm going to get from this food in relation to the amount of carbohydrate that this food is going to give me? So if we take something like rice or pasta or a piece of bread, from a nutrient perspective, all your micronutrients, your vitamins, minerals, etc., it is very poor. However, it's giving us this whack of carbohydrates. So on the other hand, we've got foods that give us just small amounts of carbohydrates, but they give us this tremendous amount and variety of micronutrients. So if you are choosing carbohydrate-based foods that give you a whole whack of other nutrients, then yes, certainly these foods are going to have value in your diet. And we're talking about vegetables, we're talking about dairy foods, we're talking about fruits and nuts and seeds. These foods give us some carbohydrates, but they also give us so many other things. So no, not all carbohydrate is bad. If I'm going to put a bad heading over something, I'm going to say, besides the whole nutrient side of it, how refined is the carbohydrate? How much has it been changed from its original form? So has it gone through a level of processing, or does it resemble its original form?
I reckon that's a great answer. Yeah. I like that. Nutrivores. I like that one. So because it's not that much of a simple answer. In fact, I often get asked by my kids who are starting to pay a little bit more attention to what they eat. You know, they'll actually get something to eat, and then they'll sit down and they'll ask the question quite innocently, you know, is this healthy for me? Is what I'm eating healthy for me? And sometimes the question is not just a black and white yes or no. There's a gray in that. And the gray is exactly what you said. You know, what is the nutrient value as compared to the caloric value? Great answer. I love that. We're off to a good start. All right. So I want to ask you secondly about carbohydrate timing. You know, there's a lot of people that talk about carbohydrate intake timing. Assuming that the carbohydrate that we're intaking is of a good nutritional value, and obviously it's got some caloric value to it as well, what's your advice on carbohydrate timing? As in, should I have carbohydrates quickly after a workout, or should I have some carbohydrates before I train? Or should I avoid carbohydrates late at night? You know, timing of carbohydrate intake. Give us your opinion on that.
Okay, so there's a lot that we can cover in there. If we start off with looking at the time of day and when the best time to incorporate carbohydrates into your diet are, well, there's a few different things that we can focus on. One of them is the hormone cortisol. Now, cortisol is something that we release when we wake up in the morning. It sort of starts coming up just before we wake up, and then we have a spike as we get out of bed. And we require this because cortisol helps us to get going in the morning. But what it also does, it can increase our insulin levels. Now, if we're increasing our insulin levels and then we throw carbohydrates first thing in the morning on top of that, we're going to have then a double whammy on our insulin levels, which is not necessarily desirable. What we're trying to do is keep our insulin levels as close to a basal state as possible throughout the day, and then we have maybe one, two, or three spikes depending on how frequently you're eating. But if you think about now, we've got it raised above a basal level first thing in the morning, so if we have a carbohydrate-heavy breakfast, we're sort of double whammy at this point in the day. So I would say, you know, people who fast in the morning, that's a great option. So it allows your time for that insulin to come back down. Or if you're not going to fast, if you feel hungry first thing in the morning, then this would be the time to minimize your carbohydrate intake. You know, have some eggs and a small amount of green leafy veggies to go with it. That's sort of the best breakfast. But sitting down to a bowl of cereal or a few pieces of toast with some jam and butter on it, you know, those are the worst options you could be going for. So in terms of the time of day, I would say the best time of day to minimize carbohydrate intake is actually earlier on in the day. Of course, then we also don't want to have a massive insulin spike overnight. We don't want the body to have to be working really hard when you've gone to sleep. You want the body to now be able to sort of turn off a little bit. And so we don't want to have a carb-heavy meal in the evening either. Mm-hmm. So if you are going to have a few carbs in your diet, it's probably best to do it in the middle of the day. That would be, from a physiological and hormonal point of view, that would be the best time of day to add some carbs in. Now, if we're talking about carbs related to exercise, so this is really interesting, and I was just been preparing a talk that I'm doing for a group of podiatrists and physiotherapists next week, and they want me to speak specifically about sports nutrition. So I was just looking at this morning, and, you know, from a sports nutrition point of view, the typical thinking is we need carbs. Carbs give us energy, and that's what's going to get us through a workout, an event, a training session, a race, whatever it might be. If your diet is very carb dominant, then yes, you need carbohydrates in order to perform at your best. And you will need to then have carbohydrates before you exercise. If you're exercising for an extended duration, you might even need to have carbohydrates during. And then you will need to replenish what we call your glycogen stores, which are basically your carbohydrate stores in your muscle and your liver. We'll need to replenish these afterwards as well. And so we need a huge amount of carbohydrates in order to exercise at these optimal levels. However, when we switch our diet and we focus more on protein, we focus more on fat, and we become what we call fat adapted. Fat adapted means that we can now tap into our fat stores when we exercise, and we are no longer dependent on carbohydrate. And really, if you're fat adapted, the only time that you need, in inverted commas, a little bit of carbohydrate is when you get to that real top high-level intense exercise, that anaerobic area where you're really pushing it so, so hard, which most people actually don't even get there. And there, at those levels, you might need a little bit of carbohydrate supplemented into your diet strategically in order to assist you at those points. So it's really, you know, the fuel you burn is dependent on the fuel you eat. So if your diet is very much carbohydrate based, you need more carbohydrate when you exercise. If it's not, if it's fat based and protein based, then actually you don't need much more, if any, carbohydrate when you exercise.
Okay. All right. Let's unpack that a little bit. There's some really good information in that. So what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that if you have a diet that is predominantly carbohydrate, your body's going to actually need and crave more carbohydrate to function efficiently. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Exactly right.
So if I've got someone, if someone's out there listening to this and they're trying to drop a little bit of body fat, if they're trying to change their body composition, what they need to be mindful of is the fact that they are carrying extra body fat is perhaps down to not just total caloric intake, but also how that caloric intake is. So if you're, let's say they're consuming 1,500 calories a day, but 70% of that 1,500 calories is carbohydrate-based, especially refined, processed, high-starch carbohydrates, their body's going to be actually craving more of that stuff.
Yes.
Right.
100%. That's exactly how it is. And the problem there is that when your body is then using that carbohydrate as your main fuel source, what happens at the same time is that your fat stores are just held in place. You know, you do not release, you cannot access your fat stores when you are burning carbohydrates. I always get people to imagine a seesaw, and on one side of the seesaw you've got carbohydrate, on the other side you've got fat. And if you increase the amount, so the seesaw with the carbohydrate is going up, you're burning more and more carbohydrate, what you're doing at the same time is burning less and less fat. Mm-hmm. So the only way to burn more and more fat is to bring that carbohydrate right down. And the lower you get the carbohydrate, the more fat you can burn.
Okay. My next question to that then is, if we've got someone who's wanting to reduce body fat, wanting to reduce overall body weight, and they know that their carbohydrate consumption is too high, what, if any, are some of the possible problems with a rapid decrease in carbohydrate intake? So what I'm saying here is Joe Citizen wakes up and goes, right, that's it, I've had enough of this, I need to drop some kilos, I'm cutting out, you know, all my carbs today. That's it. No more carbs. What could be some of the mistakes or pitfalls with that kind of strategy?
Well, look, it is possible to do that. Mm. You can certainly do that. But you would need to be aware of how your body is going to respond. And there is this adaptation period that we need to go through, which can take a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like anything, when you make changes, there's going to be some hardship before you come out the other side. And so it's really important that you are aware that you are most likely going to feel worse before you feel better. Mm-hmm. There's something that we refer to as the low carb flu. And that, you know, in a situation that you, like you've just described, most people would suffer from this low carb flu. And that is really low energy levels, feeling just completely revolting, you know, maybe even a bit lightheaded and dizzy. You might even feel a bit nauseous. So it's really those flu-like symptoms that can occur when you make such a dramatic change to your diet. But the thing is that there is light at the end of that tunnel, and the key is, if you make the decision to do that, is to, of course, do it in a way that you are getting all the right nutrients in, but with the awareness that if you keep plugging along, it will get to a point where that seesaw that I was just speaking about will switch, and you'll be at a point where you can access and use your fat, and that's when your energy levels will start picking up again, and you'll start feeling better and better until you are feeling good and hopefully better than you were before.
Okay, cool. So I guess what we're saying there is, you know, moderation is always a really good strategy to go with. When you're trying to drop some body fat, drop some weight, moderation is probably something that we tend to advise, and that is, don't do anything that's terribly radical or terribly restrictive, because for most people, that's a really hard strategy to survive. And that's exactly what you've just described, isn't it? You know, you can carbohydrate, you can cut completely or pretty much completely, but there's going to be some pain to go through. It's almost like going cold turkey off alcohol or off drugs or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, it is, but I do believe that there are people who have the personality that they want to do that, and they do it quite successfully, and sometimes I see it as a better strategy than sort of just like dipping your toes in, sitting on the fence, falling this way and that way and never quite committing. I'm personally of the opinion that if you have this real strong reason why you want to do this and make this change to your diet, mm-hmm. why not dive in head first, as long as you've got the right support at hand and that you're doing it the right way? You might go through a few days of feeling a bit yuck, but if you've got the right support and you know that you're doing it correctly and this is part of the process, then I think it's actually okay.
Now, you've probably seen a little bit of recent years of a guy who's done some work on intermittent fasting. He's not a dietitian. He's a doctor, I believe. Michael Mosley, have you read his book? I think it's called The 800. Is that right?
Yeah, I have. Read Michael Mosley's book, but I am aware of his work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed I did see him recently interviewed, can't remember where it was, but I remember seeing him interviewed, and his comment was, we used to think that rapid weight loss in the first, you know, 2, 3, 4, 6 weeks of someone trying to lose weight, we used to think that rapid weight loss was not such a great strategy. He said, but we seem to have adjusted our thinking there, and we seem to now believe that you know, rapid weight loss can actually give people the immediate reward and the reward and the affirmation that they're actually making progress. And in actual fact, rapid weight loss might be just what some people actually need. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I think it's a tricky one because often people will start and they might lose like a kilo or so, and really they've got a good 20, 30, 40 kilos to lose, and they only lose that 1 or 2 kilos and then there's like nothing. And it's extremely frustrating, disheartening for these people, and then they question the methodology and thinking, is this really the right way for me and maybe I should be doing something else? And it's very difficult to keep those people motivated and engaged. And even though I know and I've had examples of people who that rapid weight loss doesn't occur, it happens in time, it's difficult for those people to get their head around that message. So sometimes incorporating a few little things that you know will certainly cause some weight loss for whoever can be beneficial, particularly when you're dealing with a particular personality type.
Okay, cool. Good answer there. I like that. What are your thoughts on the debate around doing cardio in the morning? This is again for body fat reduction, weight reduction, because that's probably one of the biggest goals that people have, or more common ones. What's your thoughts on doing cardio in a fasted state, as in getting up, not eating anything and going straight to the gym or straight to the lounge room and doing your cardiovascular workout in a fasted state?
Yeah, I think if your goal is to lose weight and more specifically to reduce your fat, your body fat, then doing a workout in the fasted state is the best thing you could do. Your insulin is really low at that point then, because as soon as you eat, you're going to shoot your insulin up. And what your insulin does is it pushes your fat into storage. So if you are able to exercise in the fasted state, your insulin remains low and therefore you are more able to access and utilize fat and to burn fat during that workout. And then the longer you can go, so if you've done your workout at 6 a.m., you get up to do your workout and then you delay your breakfast for a few hours, your body will continue to utilize that fat.
All right. What about if I'm a person who is my goal, let's say, is not to lose weight or body fat, but to add some lean muscle tissue, but my schedule prevents me from training at night, so therefore I must train at the gym in the morning, and my primary goal is to add some muscle. How would you treat me if they were my goals? What would you advise?
So we know that protein intake and an adequate amount of protein, specifically the amino acid leucine, is vitally important for protein synthesis to occur. Now, we can stimulate protein synthesis by simply eating protein and sufficient amounts of protein. Do we need to do that at the same time as our workout? No, not necessarily. So you'd need to have an optimal eating plan for muscle growth, and then your exercise program needs to be for that hypertrophy, that building of muscle as well. But it doesn't mean that the eating needs to happen around the exercise. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to get up and have that protein and then exercise. They don't actually work together in that sense. But as long as both of those programs are optimized, then you're going to achieve those goals. So you could, if you are comfortable exercising in the fasted state, perhaps you're following more of a lower carbohydrate diet, then you would be more comfortable exercising and performing well at a in a fasted state. But if you're carbohydrate dependent, you probably are going to need something to eat in order to work out at your optimal level. So it then depends on what your diet is based on.
So if I was, if that was my goal and I had to do a strength session or a hypertrophy based session in the morning, it would be, say, I would wake up and perhaps have something that is a relatively good source of carbohydrate. I don't know, maybe let's say a banana perhaps to give me some energy.
Yeah, if your diet is carbohydrate based, then yes, that's what you would want to do. You would have to get up and just have, it doesn't have to be something large, but just something that is going to restore your glycogen levels so that you don't sort of hit the wall during your sessions. Because if our glycogen stores are too depleted, and they do deplete overnight, mm-hmm. we just want to top them up to prevent that hitting of the wall during our session and allow us to train at our highest level. But this is only if you are carbohydrate dependent.
So once I finish my strength session, what's your recommendation on how quickly I should be getting some protein and carbs into my system following that workout? Is it within half an hour? Yeah. Is it within an hour? Does it not matter? What's your advice there?
So again, it always comes back to what is your diet to begin with. So if you are a lower carb athlete, if you are following sort of my typical approach, low carb, higher fat, then it does not matter when you eat. You need to obviously continue to follow the protocol of good protein, some veggies and good fats, but it does not matter when you have that meal. And I would be telling you to have that meal when you felt hungry. Mm-hmm. And if that was immediately following your session, go for it. And if it was only 5 hours later, that would be fine too. But if you are carbohydrate dependent, there's actually been shown that there's this window of greater uptake of carbohydrates following exercise. And so you'd want to take advantage of that, and you'd want to try and eat within that window so that you can get those carbs coming in quickly and you can actually get your body back to and recover as quickly as possible. So it's about a half hour to an hour window within which you want to eat. And I would sit down to a proper meal if you could. Sometimes that's not possible. You might be at the gym or you're at the pool or wherever you are, you can't do that. And then it would be trying to just get something in the interim that covered all nutrient bases, macronutrient bases. So a good amount of carbs, a good amount of protein, a good amount of fat, and then sit down to a good meal as soon as you practically possibly could.
Okay, cool. What's the advice these days? What's the recommendations these days around the amount of protein for a person to consume on a daily basis? Because it used to be kind of low, around 0.8 to 1 gram per kilo of body weight per day. Now it seems to be up a little higher. I've heard 1.5. I've heard 1.8. I've even had some people talk about 2. Like what's the recommendations now?
Yeah, you know, Russell, this is probably the most embarrassing part of sports nutrition, that we still actually don't have some really good numbers in this regard. We do, yeah, it used to be right down at that 0.8 and even 0.6, I remember seeing, which is way too low, in my opinion. But if you started looking at, you know, people speak about high protein. What's a high protein diet? Do we have a definition for that?
Yep.
We don't really have any definitions what's the optimal amount. But what we have had is some studies to show us that there's a level that if we go beyond that and we keep having these high levels, we can accumulate ammonia and a bunch of other negative things within our body. And if we start doing that, that can become quite dangerous. And those levels are right up at about 3.3 grams per kilogram body weight per day. And then on the lower end, you've got that 0.6 or 0.8. And then we've got this massive window in between where the science is like, oh, well, somewhere in there it's probably okay. The most recent guidelines that I saw were sitting for athletes or people who engage in exercise frequently was sitting somewhere between 1.2 and 2.2, mm-hmm. which I think is probably a fair call. It's a big range still. You know, if you look at a 70-kilo person and you times their weight by 1.2 or 2.2, that's a massive difference in the absolute amount of protein that you're having.
Indeed.
So it's a very tricky question, but I do also like to point out to people the importance of having an adequate amount per meal. So rather than just focusing at a per day amount, we really need that. I don't know if you're aware of the leucine threshold. I sometimes just call it the protein threshold. This is the amount of protein, more specifically the amino acid leucine that we require to stimulate protein synthesis. Mm-hmm. So if we don't stimulate protein synthesis, then basically we use the protein just for energy. And really, we don't want to use protein for energy. We want to use carbs and fat for energy. We want protein to be for all that building and repairing and regeneration. And so if we have an adequate amount of leucine and we reach that threshold at a particular sitting, at a particular meal, then we will stimulate protein synthesis. Now, that amount, to put it into grams, it's 3 grams of leucine, which accounts to approximately between 25 and 30 grams of protein. So if you can aim for between, you know, at least at a minimum between 25 and 30 grams of protein per meal, then you are stimulating protein synthesis, which should be the aim. And I'll just point out that, you know, 25, 30 grams of protein is not 25 or 30 grams of meat. Mm. It's the protein. So, you know, a lot of people get confused and, you know, 100 grams of meat contains roughly 20, 21 grams of protein. So you'd need about 120 grams, 130 grams of meat in order to get that 25 to 30 grams of protein.
That's a very good point. So let's asterisk that. That is indeed very true. So what Vicky's saying is if you go to the supermarket and you get a 200 gram Scotch fillet steak, you are not consuming 200 grams of protein.
Yeah,
there's a
yeah,
lot. There's exactly. There's a lot less protein, actual true protein, in that steak than the 200 grams that it weighs. Okay, that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Can you also talk to me a little bit about glycemic index? Because I've heard various opinions on whether or not the glycemic index is still relevant. I still feel that there's value in understanding what the glycemic index is. So I want you to quickly, just very quickly, give me a definition of that so that people who haven't heard the term understand it. But secondly, does the glycemic index still apply in your thinking and your, you know, in your advice to people when they eat food?
Yeah, so the glycemic index was something that was actually an Australian thing. So it came about through some research at Sydney University by a researcher by the name of Jenny Brand Miller, probably a good 20 plus years ago now. And what she did was she basically took glucose and measured the response to glucose. And when I say response, it's your glycemic response. So how much glucose arrives in your system when you consume pure glucose. And she gave that a value of 100. And then she compared all other foods, so any food that contains carbohydrate, to glucose and gave it a number. So, you know, like something like white bread is very, very, it has a very similar glycemic index to glucose. It gives us that much glucose in our bloodstream that it's just like eating pure glucose, which is quite revolting. Mm. But then, you know, she compared fruits and vegetables and dairy, and we found that a whole bunch of factors influenced the amount of glucose that was then seen in our bloodstream. And so this system came about, and it was seen to be desirable to have lower glycemic index foods because these then didn't cause such a spike of glucose, and therefore they were more beneficial, or you know, better for us, or whatever the thing was. And it's funny because not many other countries have taken up the glycemic index as something that's valid. So, you know, it being here in Australia and the research being done in Australia has made there's greater awareness of glycemic index, and it has been used a heck of a lot more in Australia than in other countries. But, you know, it's important to really understand the ins and outs and what it means in terms of your insulin response and all sorts of things. Now, one of the biggest criticisms of glycemic index is that it doesn't account for something that we call the area under the curve. And if you think of a graph, and you get a spike and then it comes back down, and then we can measure that area underneath that spike. Now, if it's a really big spike and it comes down quickly, we might get a certain number, but we can get a very similar number when we don't have a big spike, but it sticks around for ages. And this is the problem with low glycemic index food, is that it's thought to be possibly just as bad, in inverted commas, I won't say bad, but it's, you know, there's some thought that it's not as good maybe as we thought, because the glycemic response sticks around for so much longer. And at the end of the day, the area under the curve is the same.
Right. Yep.
So we're still having the same amount of glucose in our system. We're just not having it in one big whack. Now, is there benefit in that, or could it even be worse? And there's some people who argue that that could potentially be worse, because now it's causing insulin to just be coming, you know, sticking around at this sort of hover little level all day long, whereas insulin is a hormone that should be released in pulses.
Right.
There's very definite different sides of the fence when we talk about glycemic index. I think it's way more beneficial just to look at the total number of carbohydrates rather than glycemic index.
And as you said earlier in the podcast, not only that, but to look at the nutritional value of the carbohydrate that you're intaking as well. Okay,
yeah,
cool. All right. 100%. Because we'll still probably arrive at the same kind of answer anyway. You know, if the source of your carbohydrate is carbohydrate that is highly refined and has a lot of processed activity around it, well, it's probably going to be not that good for you anyway. Okay.
Exactly.
All right, cool. We got there. I like it. Did you hear recently, a little bit off the topic, but I did hear recently that there was some questioning as to the nutritional value, or whether or not you could actually categorize the bread that you get in Subway as bread. Have you heard something around that recently?
I haven't heard, but that's a good one.
Yeah. No, well, the question was coming from the point of view that because the sugar content of their bread was so high, the question then arose, well, can you actually call it bread? Because it's now almost considered a confectionery. Anyway, a little off the topic, but interesting nonetheless. Vicky, I want to ask you this one. There's a lot of diets going, you know, there's you just got to open up social media or listen to the radio or the TV for a period, and someone will be promoting some form of diet. I don't need you to break down everything, but what are your thoughts on the CSIRO diet? Are you familiar with the CSIRO diet? I'm sure you are.
Yeah, look, I'm familiar with it to a degree. I don't know in detail what they're recommending because their recommendations do change.
Mm.
And I'm not actually 100% sure, to be completely honest, what their recommendations are right now. I know that they have moved to more of a lower carbohydrate approach. I think they are quite fond of promoting protein. I think they're still quite wary of fat.
From last looking at it, it was around about 40, 30, and 30. So 40% protein, 30% carb, 30% fat. I think.
Yeah.
Don't quote me, but I think it was along those lines.
You know, like if you look at a ketogenic diet, you might be looking at upper end of 70% fat.
Mm.
They would, you know, which can be a very healthy approach if done correctly. I my opinion when it comes to all these different diets is, number one, I think the essence of any diet or anything that you eat, like the main thing that you should be looking at is trying to eat naturally occurring foods. We should be eating real whole foods, and that should be the absolute number one thing, staying away from processed foods. And then it is so individualized in terms of what macronutrient makeup is going to work for you. Like it really makes me giggle a little bit to myself when I hear things as specific as 40-30-30. Like, I wonder who's actually calculating that on mm-hmm. a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
Because even for me, as a nutritionist who has been doing this for 20-plus years now, like, one day of calculating intake would do my head in. Like, seriously, who is doing that? It's just crazy. Like, you could maybe sort of estimate, but my goodness, what a load of work to attain something like that.
So on that very point, I'm going to stop you there, because let's just talk about that, because that was one of my questions. Are you a proponent of looking at your plate? How do you manage the structure of your own daily intake so that you know roughly that you're getting the right amount of nutrients from the sources that you want? So clearly what you've just said is you're not into counting calories, nor am I, because I just think, oh my God, what a pain in the backside that would be to have to do that every day. But I know that you must have a fairly good understanding of where you're getting your macronutrients from. So how do you personally manage that? Is it just estimation?
I am estimating, yes, but I think I'm doing a pretty good job of estimating just by having a, you know, groups of food that I'm going to choose from with very definite goals in regards to each of those groups. So, you know, for me, it's always about thinking about, you know, I always speak to people about this three-step process when it comes to putting a meal together. It should always start by thinking about the protein component. That should be the essence of your meal. That should be where your meal planning begins. So you first start off with choosing your protein source, and then going back to what we spoke about just before about that 25 to 30 gram protein as being a minimum. If I'm feeling hungrier, then I'll have more, but, you know, that would be the minimum. And then working from there, my next step is that I want to have a variety of vegetables on my plate. I want to emphasize green vegetables, particularly dark green veggies. So there's always going to be some of those in my day, and then I'll bring in some other colors. And then the third step is that I want to add some good quality fat. Now, if I've got meat that, or the protein that is pretty fatty, like a lamb chop or something of that, then I'm going to add in smaller amounts of fat. But if I've chosen a lean piece of protein, like a chicken breast, then I need to add in more fat. So I'm just balancing things on the plate in that regard. If I am having carbohydrate, it is definitely an afterthought. it is never part of the initial planning, and it's just something that comes in as extra. And when I say carbohydrate, I'm talking about, you know, your nutrient poor carbohydrates, which seldom come onto my plate. But if people are wanting to include them, like they want a little bit of rice or they want a little bit of pasta or a piece of bread, then it's your final thought. You want to make sure you've got those other three things in place first. You fill up on that stuff, and then the carbs are just there as a little bit of an extra. So that's my process. There is never any counting. The only people who I do get counting is when there's very, very specific needs, you know, and the one that always pops into thought is kids, specifically kids who might have type 1 diabetes or they have some, you know, some disease, particularly something like epilepsy, and we're trying to get them to achieve a certain number of a level of ketones in their blood in order to reduce their medication. And it's so, so specific. And it's really very much often life and death sort of stuff. That's when we count. But for your everyday person like this, seriously, I just don't think it's sustainable or realistic or anything to be counting calories and counting carbs or counting things.
I agree. One more question. I've got a number of people over the journey that have always, you know, wanting to lose weight, wanting to lose body fat. And one of the problems that they have is that they have this tendency to eat after dinner. So they snack. They often look for something to eat after their last meal of the day. And quite often what they're looking for also is something that's sweet. What are the strategies that you advise people to implement to try and curb that behavior?
I think that a lot of that is mindset stuff. I do think that there's a definite sugar craving, sugar addiction thing that we physiologically have. And if you're ready to get rid of that, then it certainly is possible, you know, and I'd get people to start off by just having lesser of those things. And when I say lesser sweetness, so maybe straight after dinner you're going to sit down and you're going to have a bowl of some berries and you're going to put some cream on that with a bit of scattered dark chocolate over the top or something, so that you feel still like you're having something of sweetness, even though it's not a bar of Cadbury chocolate or something. So there's strategies to minimize sweetness over time by introducing more natural sweetness through fruits and those sorts of things. But I really believe that there's great value in looking at mindset when it comes to those habits of eating. And I've just started working with a mindset coach and we're developing a bit of a program together, because so often I find that there's just these little things in terms of behavior and self-sabotage and all sorts of things that go on. And from a nutritional point of view, they don't make sense. And for some people, it's just easy to stop doing that and it's finished and you never think of it again. But for others, there's this comfort, there's something else that they gain from that behavior. And it's about recognizing that, understanding that, and then finding an alternative way around it.
Which kind of, now I've just thought of one more question that I have to ask you. Do you yourself, with your clients and people that work with you, if they're wanting to change behavior around food, if they're wanting to adjust things and that they know they have to and that you're advising them to, do you get people to keep a food diary or a log using an app of what they eat, when they eat, how much they eat? Do you track things like that initially or not?
Not always. I guess it depends on the person and what I'm looking for, and also how that individual person is going to respond to that, because some people love to do that and it makes them feel accountable and in control, and other people absolutely despise it. So it really depends on the individual. I know that's a really vague answer, but it does. It so comes down to what that person is wanting to do, is able to, willing, that sort of thing.
Yeah. No, that makes complete sense. Well, I think we've covered some really good basic questions today, and that was the aim of today, was to not get too sciencey, but just really talk about the common questions and problems and concerns that people have. Now, you're based in Melbourne, so for those people listening, you are still kind of heavily locked down, and certainly your facility is closed, as is mine. And I'm sure a lot of people are reaching out to you online and via email and all the rest of it. So for people to contact you and work with you, if they can't see you in your facility and work with you directly face-to-face, what's the best form of contact at the moment? Because I know coming off the back of this, people are going to have questions and want to perhaps engage your services. So how do they do that?
Yeah, so I am still seeing people one-on-one, just obviously all through Zoom. Zoom is the new favourite thing. So that is most definitely an option. But I also have an online program that people can access, and this is a six-week program that takes people step-by-step into adopting a lower carbohydrate diet and becoming more fat-adapted and taking them through all those expectations and support that we spoke about. So it's very much a handheld program. That can be accessed through my website, lowcarbchallenge.com.au. And then there's a whole bunch of other information on there and a few free challenges and recipes and things that you can pick up. My other website for the studio and our physical premises is eatplaythrive.com.au, and there's a bunch of other things on there as well.
Excellent. And I'll put all those in the show notes as well so that people can reach out to you. It's my understanding, Vicky, that through this whole lockdown process that Melbourne has been in the middle of for many months now, that there's a significant increase in anxiety, mental health condition, and issues around that. But also too, it seems that the population is really struggling to manage their food and their nutrition and eat well. Are you expecting off the back of this that people are going to come back to you with a sort of a significant change in their body weights? Is that something that you're expecting to see?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, I think so. I think that there has been a small amount of people who have used this as an opportunity to get on top of their health and fitness and weight and all of that. And potentially, and possibly that was something that happened initially. But I think for the majority of people, it's just become too hard. It's been too long. It's been such a drag that food has been sometimes the only comfort. And, you know, no finger pointing at all at this point, because I don't know what people had to turn to options right now. So, you know, hopefully once things return to semi-normal, people will be able to return to that. But, of course, the likes of yourself and myself are hopefully people can lean on us for the support that they require if they're not able to manage that themselves when the time comes.
No, I agree. I think my estimation out of all of this is that more people are going to be needing, you know, significant health and wellness guidance and advice than ever before, because, like, I agree with you, and I think initially everyone's like, right, well, I'm gonna reset my life, I'm gonna reset my diet, my exercise, and they did all that in lockdown one, but lockdown two has been a completely different situation, and I think they've gone backwards. I think a lot of people have really gone backwards, and I think we're going to see some horrific statistics when we finally get back to, in inverted commas, normal. Vic, thank you. Thank you so much for your time once again. I think what I enjoy the most about talking to you is the common sense of your answers. You know, you don't have you know, you're not sitting out there at the left or the right of the dietetics opinion, you know, spectrum. You're very much a person with common sense, with moderation, with logic, and that is what I think allows people to follow good eating habits. It's just keep it moderated, just keep it logical. And if you stick to the basics of whole foods, and preparing your food from scratch and essentially looking after your own food intake without relying on others to do it for you, you can't go far wrong. You can't go far wrong. Well done. Well done, girl. It's been great. I appreciate it. Love your work. And I want people to go and search you out if they need your help because it's well worth their while. Good work, Vicky. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Australian Fitness Podcast is all about some education, insight, inspiration, motivation, lessons and learnings from myself and the various fitness professionals that I interview on this podcast. To help me get the message across, I'll be tapping into the minds and careers of other successful fitness experts to see just how they go about their trade. I'd love for you, the listener, to connect with the Australian Fitness Podcast. So please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at the Australian Fitness Podcast. If you have any comments or questions or would like to make contact, you can do so at info@australianfitnesspodcast.com.au. Finally, I am a working strength and conditioning coach, so if you want to reach out to me for professional services, programs, education and seminars, you can do so via email russell@russelljarrett.com.au. Thanks for listening.